Kentuckery. The Maine outdoors is waiting for all of us to see. The mountains, lakes, and rivers, the wildlife, and the woods are just outside your way. So get outside and find it in the Maine outdoors. Fishing and hunting, winter, spring, summer, and fall. If it happens in the Maine outdoors, they talk about it all. Just tune in your radio to 103.9. Jim and Paul and Bob and Matt are your outdoors hotline. Each Sunday night at 7 on WVOM. To find out what is happening, just listen to the radio to the Maine outdoors.
Welcome to the Maine outdoors. Here's tonight's host, V. Paul Reynolds.
Well, not quite. As we all know, V. Paul has still got his Speedo on down there in the Keys of Florida. He's not quite ready to get back to us yet, but I've heard some peepers peeping and things like that, so it won't be long. This is Bob Mercer sitting in for him, and welcome tonight. I hope we have a show that will keep your interest, and maybe even you'll even learn a little bit of something before we get done. I will start off with the Outdoor Digest, sponsored by the Northwoods Sporting Journal, to me, which is Maine's premier outdoor newspaper, and it's been in the business for quite a while. And you go online, you can look up their information, and be sure to get yourself a subscription if you don't have one. My digest tonight is going to be just a little bit political, and I hope I don't get in trouble, but I'm going to do it anyway. I read Paul's column in the editorial in the journal last week about kids and boats and how they're going to try to make a law or a rule that a kid under a certain age has to take a test before he can drive a motorboat by himself and all that kind of a thing. And it harkened me back to the idea of personal responsibility and parental responsibility and all that type of thing. When I was a sprout, which wasn't yesterday, my folks had a camp on Craig Pond, and I'd get up in the morning when I was, 10, 11 years old, and I'd run down in that dock and jump in that boat and pull a cord on that 7.5 Ember Root, and away I went. And Mother probably didn't see me until after lunchtime or anything, but nobody worried about it, no problem or anything like that. And I learned to drive, basically. Most of the kids around Bucksport learned to drive going to the dump. Dump day was on Saturday and stuff, and you had to jump in. You jump in the driver's seat, and away you go. There's no Ford driver radar and that kind of stuff. And we all grew up with BB guns, and then when we get over that, we kind of graduated 22, and we were out skulking around and with our 22s. And the only rule it has is that I was told right point blank up front that you shoot it, you eat it. So I was very careful about what I shot and things like that. And so I learned the responsibility and all that type of thing. And I have this terrible feeling that we're just overprotecting kids today. And they're not held responsible for things. We try to take all the responsibility on ourselves and tell them by law sometimes and these different things, they can't do this. Well, sometimes common sense would say they could do this if they were allowed to. And, you know, I hunted with a shotgun, probably I was about 12 years old, all by my lonesome. And it was against law. I was supposed to be 15, but sometimes it was a kind of a sneak deal. But we did it and everything. And I feel very sad about this way that we're telling everybody you can't do this and you can't do that and you got to have this rule and that rule and everything. And I looked up today, Ben Franklin made a statement about that. He said, those who would trade essential liberty for a little safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. And I think that's something that I think we got to be cautious of these things and pay attention to what folks in Augusta and places like that are doing, because I think that they're taking too much control of too many things. And, you know, aside of that, I voted against the seatbelt law years ago. I wear my seatbelt every day. Always have, ever since we got one. But I didn't want the government telling me to do it for my own protection. So, you know, I don't think you can legislate stupidity. And so if somebody chooses to be stupid, then so be it. And now to quote Forrest Gump, that's all I got to say about that. Our guest tonight is Matt LaRoche, and I was excited to have Matt agree to come on with us tonight. Matt's the retired superintendent of the Allegash Wilderness Waterway, and is the owner of
Maine Woods Guide Service.
Maine Woods Guide Service, there you go. Why don't you, Matt, right off quick, give the people, if they wanted to contact you at Maine Woods Guide Service, how they do that.
Well, my preferred method would be to just go onto the website, which is MaineWoodsGuide.com. MaineWoodsGuide.com. We just updated the website, and it's got some new photos on there, and you can pay online. So it's pretty high tech for a old guy website, but it's MaineWoodsGuide.com.
Yeah. Okay. So, and don't be afraid as we go through here to repeat that, because people might say, "Yeah, what do I want to do that for?" And we might say or do something happened tonight that excites somebody, and they might want to do that. So, excuse me. Now, you've spent a good part of your life living around the outdoors and stuff, being the superintendent of the waterway and all that kind of stuff. What's the foundation of that? Where did that come from?
Well, you know, I was going to university. The story goes back a little further, So I graduated from high school. My father says, "Well, what are you going to do, you know, after you graduate from high school?" And I said, "Well, I think I'll hang around Lisbon Falls, Maine, and maybe figure out what I want to do." And he says, "Well, no, you're not." And he says, "You're going to University of Maine." So we get into the car, and he took me up to Orono, where he went, and we met with a few people that he knew. And so I agreed. I said, "Well, Dad, I'll take that two-year course, and if I like it, I'll take two more years." And part of the curriculum was that I got hired by North Maine Woods. And we basically got credit for working one semester and working for North Maine Woods. We cleaned campsites and made different campsites. I worked on the gate a few days a week. And so I was up there not too long, and I pretty much saw these Allegash guys in the gray uniforms going by. And I said, "Those guys get the best job. They're on the river all the time." So next year I applied for the waterway, and I got hired. And I just stayed on and learned. I worked for the Allegash for 10 years, and I went to the West Branch for 20-some.
West Branch of the Penobscot.
West Branch of the Penobscot, and then I went back as a superintendent of the waterway at the end of my career. So it was a really good career. I got to meet a lot of nice people and got to go fishing after work, you know, as much as I wanted.
Well, now, that's the highlight.
Yeah.
Now, what are some of the things that people wouldn't think of that you have to do as a superintendent of the waterway that might not be quite so high?
Well, you know,
I can think of one right off quick.
When I was superintendent of the water, I kind of got removed a little bit from some of the daily routine. Mine was, you know, trying to get the stuff and the training that all the rangers needed. So I was a little bit removed from the firsthand contact with the public, unless I wanted to. A lot of times I'd want to go meet with especially some of the guides that came through. Oh, you know, the downside of being the actual superintendent was like the deadlines and the meetings. And, you know, you really only got to spend about half your time on the waterway. The rest of the time it was some meeting with either the landowners or somebody in state government.
Budget,
yeah. I mean, all that sort of things that, you know, the management plan, all that sort of thing. It's not really that much fun. But, you know, it's pretty good on a 20-below day or a rainy day to be able to do that stuff and not have to go out and on the woods and waters.
Certainly. Now, you've seen numerous people come through the waterway, obviously. The first time I was on the waterway, I made a mistake, and it was almost a bad one. We snuck in to Eagle Lake through Indian Stream, and I had my Old Town Tripper canoe loaded. We were headed for the pump campsite. And looked out there, it was nice all the way up, nice clear day. I had the 2 horsepower purring along. My friend with me had a 4 horsepower on his canoe. Well, the wind was blowing away from us. We couldn't see the whitecaps. We couldn't see the waves. And about halfway up, we got into some deep stuff, and the waves started picking my canoe up and surfing it. And it would start to, and then when it started to surf, the motor would cavitate. And when it started to slide around sideways, and just at the last minute, it would stop surfing, that motor would dig in, and I'd straighten route again. We did that all the way to the pump.
Wow.
it was interesting because the fellow was with me, had never been done anything, never been outdoors before, and he jumped out of the canoe. He said, "Wow," he said, "that was great." He said, "I like that." And I said, "Well, I didn't think very much of it." But anyway, what is the point of that conversation is, what's the most common mistake that people make when they plan a trip for like an extended canoe trip like that on the Allegash?
Well, I'd say being ill-prepared for the trip itself, because it's a long time to be out to organize your food. A lot of people bring too much stuff, right? They overload these canoes and they swamp them that way, or the canoe is too small. People would call me and ask us, you know, I wouldn't take a canoe less than 16 foot, preferably an 18 footer, down the Allegash. You could bring your stuff and have free board so too small a canoes, too much stuff, and not well enough prepared. But we did do when I was on the waterway, we did a video series to help people to better prepare to come to the waterway, so they could expect, you know, what to expect, and maybe a little bit about the history and about the fishing and things. So that actually helped quite a bit. So when people would call, I said, "Look, watch the video series. You still got questions, call me back."
Yeah. And see, what I learned from that experience is when we go, I always check the weather and which way the wind's blowing before I put in. When you get there, you're on a lake or something, you can tell how the wind's blowing, but
the headwater lakes, that's the bane of canoeing on the headwater lakes, right? You're at the mercy of the wind.
And Norm tells me we got to take a little time off here.
It's a little break time.
Time for a break.
And
all right,
here we go.
Now, are there many people in this day and age, from your experience, that actually do the Allegash trip leaving from Greenville?
Not too many. No, there's a few. There's a few that come down the West Branch. They'll put in at like Hannibal's Crossing or Lobster Trip and come down. There's a few that do that, and there's that Northern Forest Canoe Trail is not real popular, but there's quite a few that come through that way.
There's some fair amount of walking on that Northern Forest Canoe Trail.
Yeah, well, once you get to Moose River there, it's all downhill from there.
Yeah. See, we did my wife and I and another couple did the upper part of the West Branch. We did it from Subumic down to Chesuncook.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice trip.
And it's a good couple's, it's a wonderful family trip, because there's no real white water, and you got a nice current behind you, and it was pretty. We enjoyed it.
And there's a lot of wildlife. You probably saw lots of wildlife.
Oh, we saw a lot of moose.
Yeah.
We saw a lot of moose. Matter of fact, we stayed at Throw Camp site there, and I get up right on the edge of daylight because I had to visit with nature, and I got up and I looked over the bank, and there was two moose right there. There was a foggy and everything. Of course, everybody got up, and we had an early day that day. Yeah. But now, how did what's your transition from being a superintendent of the waterway go from there to guiding? Did you start working on guiding while you were still superintendent, or does that later on? Or how'd you make that transition?
Well, actually, when I was working on the West Branch, I met Wiggy Robinson, became friends with him. We went fishing all the trout ponds in that area, and Wiggy at the time was on the guide board. In fact, I didn't know Wiggy was as big a deal as it was until I went and took my guide test, and everything's down there. Wiggy Robinson Legendary Guide Award and all this Wiggy stuff. So anyway, but. So Wiggy and I were talking, and he was on the guide board. He says, "I'll give you a mock test." So I went into the camp there, and he started, "What kind of a life jacket is this? You know, type 3, type 2? And I said, "Man, there's a lot of stuff I don't know, you know." And so I said, "Well, I'm not ready to go take my guide test yet." And I did a little bit of studying. Basically, quite a few years later, I said, "Well, I was thinking about retiring." I said, "You know what? I think I'd like to guide." And so I went and studied up the law books and read Gil Gilpatrick's book on becoming an outdoor leader and practice with a map and compass. In fact, a friend of mine was Roger Gay, was a warden, and he gave me a Be Expert with Map and Compass handbook that the wardens used to practice with. And I practiced with that quite a bit, and I thought I was ready and sent in for my take the test and passed with flying colors, and went back and got my hunting one afterwards.
Hunting, yeah. You never did a rafting guide?
Never did a rafting guide. I was around rafting a lot on the West Branch and never really had a desire to do that. Some people do, but it wasn't for me. I prefer to stay a little bit drier in my endeavors on the water.
You didn't want to guide on a roller coaster.
No.
Now, that's an exciting thing. I told you, I have a son that's been on the West Branch for 23 years, and he loves it. He wouldn't do anything else. He's got a good thing. He's a phys ed teacher in the wintertime.
Oh, that is a good gig.
Raft guide in the summertime. Now, you kind of explained it, but how you became a guide and everything. Now, there's a lot of people in this day and age, they have guide schools.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with that process?
Yes, I know in fact, my brother took a guide's, got his guide license through a school. And I think that's pretty much the way to go because they know what you're going to be tested on and what the questioning will be. So really, if I wanted to be a main guide, I probably would go take that course. But, I was just stubborn enough that I didn't want to take the course, figuring I'd done my whole career doing that sort of thing. So I just studied the law books and my map and compass, you got to know that. You got to know your back azimuth. You got to know true north, magnetic north. There's a lot of questions, and you got to know how to read a map. And that's the first thing they throw at you. And if you screw up there, you just get dismissed. You got to come back, try it again later.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people, when I was teaching earth science years ago, I had a session on map and compass, and we did some orienteering and that type of a thing. The kids liked it.
Yeah, I enjoyed the work I was doing, getting ready to take the test. I enjoyed doing that orienteering type stuff.
Yeah. So you went fishing, Wiggy, you must have been to Valhalla.
No. The first time we went to Slaughter Pond.
You didn't go to Center Pond?
No, I never went to Center. He talked about it, but I never went there. But he took me to a lot of other ponds.
But before he got more advanced and everything, he always talked about going to Valhalla, I believe. I may be stand corrected, but he didn't like to tell people where that was, but I think it was Center Pond.
Yeah, he did talk about that. In fact, the first time I went fishing with him, then he was asking me every night, every time he saw me, you want to go fishing tonight? You want to go fishing? He wanted somebody to go with, right?
Yeah.
Just to go with. Finally, I had to tell him, Wiggy, I can't go every night. He says, like Fridays and Saturday nights, I used to like to patrol on the West Branch, keep kind of law and order a little bit. And I said, my wife wants me to do something with her once in a while too, So, but I went a lot, he took me to a lot of neat places that I probably never would have got to without him taking me there.
No, it makes you wonder about people like that. Is the amount of time they had to have put in the outer doors to obtain all that knowledge.
Well, he grew up there.
Yeah.
He told me the story about him and his brother Ralph going to Baxter State Park for the summer, and they would go to Baxter into Chimney Pond, and they would go to Roaring Brook, and they would carry people's packs to Chimney Pond for pay. Yeah. And that's what he said. We left with a stack of saltines and a jar of peanut butter for the whole summer. And he said, Ralph and him got into a fight on the way in there, and Ralph smashed a jar of peanut butter on a rock. So he grew up there.
So he must have been in there at Chimney Pond at the time when Roy Dudley was there.
I think he was.
He must have been. Because my mom met Roy Dudley. She went to Camp Natasswee in the late 30s. And of course, there was a lot of tripping. They tripped all the time. And when they went to Chimney Pond, they met Roy Dudley. And he had campfires and told them stories and all that kind of stuff.
He was kind of famous for that, wasn't he?
Yeah, well,
his campfire stories.
There's a book called Chimney Pond Tales.
Yep.
The lady found some wax recordings of his storytelling. And that Chimney Pond Tales is those stories. It's pretty neat. It's pretty kind of neat. Now, I had a guide's license for a while. I didn't have to go through what you did. I just went and saw the local game board, and he asked me a couple of questions and gave me the thing, you're a guide. So that was interesting. I thought it was a big deal. There was a while that people got in trouble, and so they really perked it up later on. I did that it would have been about 1972.
Yeah, that's quite a while ago.
So it was, a friend of mine had an outfit, and we used to guide folks and everything down around West Grand and Junior Lake and down that area. But how do you, when you're guiding, how do you deal with the pain in the neck?
Well, I haven't really had one of those yet. Well, yes, I have had one. Okay. Actually, I guided a trip last summer. I guess I don't want to say too much. You never know who's out there listening. No. But nobody wanted this other person in his canoe. So obviously he went to the guide's canoe. And he had a hard time following directions. It was like he was one of these persons that wanted to paddle hard and always wanted to, I'd say, the water was low on the Allagash, so I would tell him, we're going to go down through here on the left, and then we're going to follow the current over to the right, and we're going to go down through there. And then he'd want to change direction on me, you know, like he knew better, but he paddled way too hard. It's like he was paddling like he was in a race all the time. And I said, I take a few strokes, I take a break. So anyway, he ended up going in my canoe because nobody else really wanted to get along with it. But, you know, part of, I think, being a park manager and superintendent, you kind of got to be able to get along with everybody and smooth things over. And so I haven't really had the real bad pain in the neck yet. But
we had one.
Well, you remembered, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. We had a father and two sons from Revere, Massachusetts. Their last name ended in a vowel, and he couldn't tell me what he did for work. And anyway, and they were just the highlight. We stayed at a campsite, and we caught some perch. I mean, nice ones, 1.5 pound, 2 pound white perch. I mean, nice ones. We flayed them all out, and they said, what are we going to have for supper tonight? And they said, well, we're going to fly out those fish we caught this afternoon. We're going to have them for supper.
Sure.
Said, we don't like fish.
Don't like fish. Well.
So we always kept a Hormel canned ham for emergencies.
Yeah, that's great.
So when they weren't looking, we opened up that can, put it on a cookie sheet, put some maple syrup and some peaches, I think it was, of it, and stuck it in a reflector oven, put it in front of the fire. And we had supper, and he kept shaking his head. This guy did, shaking his head. And he was just being he's belligerent, pain in the neck. He said, I don't understand. I said, what's the matter? Didn't suffer? His nose was wonderful, which was good to start off with.
Cause that's good.
And he said, but I don't understand. I said, what? He said, it takes my wife all day to cook a ham at home. And you did that in that fire in about an hour.
Yeah.
I said, well, you just have to know. But they were just, oh, they were just.
Interesting you should talk about reflector ovens, though, because I have one. Actually, I have two. And Gil Gilpatrick gave me the bigger one, and he's a pretty famous guy, too.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a show-off thing, you know. When you go there and you can make either biscuits or cornbread right in front of the fire, people really they really enjoy that, just seeing you do it.
Yeah. My dad was a sheet metal worker. He was a tinsmith at St. Regis Champion Paper.
Yep.
So he built a reflector oven that was foldable.
Mm-hmm.
And he built it, and he put a hood out over the front of it so it could even catch more light. And I like to cook biscuits and stuff. It really amazes people.
I mean, I got one of those big frying pans, you know, the big ones. And if you put that on the fire and then put this reflector oven in front, it kind of forces the heat towards the reflector oven a little bit.
Yeah.
It seems to work a lot better if you put something on top of the, so the flame, so the heat doesn't go up, it has to come out the sides.
Well, that's what he did. He had the reflector oven, and he had like an awning that went out over it about a foot, hung out over the front of it. And so you put the oven right up next to the fire, and then that awning kind of went out over the over the fire. It works good. But that's how you get to show off a little bit with the people. And
I think Sproul is still making those fold-up reflectors.
Is that right?
Yeah. They're making nice oven.
Well, this is a stainless steel one.
Yeah, well, they are.
Where's Sproul located anyways?
You know, I think he's up around the Lincoln area.
Oh, okay.
He used to go to the Cabin Fever Reliever Show.
Correct.
I know he was there making them.
Right, They've come up quite a bit. I mean, when I first was introduced to Reflector Oven, they were somewhere around $45, and I should have grabbed them there because I think they're a lot more now.
Yeah, he's $100 or so for his Reflector Oven. Maybe he's more. He comes with a little cookbook, though, but you can't get them. Go try to find one on the internet. You can't really find one.
You can't find them.
You can't do this. You know,
it's kind of a main thing.
Yeah, I did a guides course up in northern Maine a bit, and we used the reflector oven. That was my first time with reflector oven. It impressed me. Put it that way, you know, to be out there and bake something, I definitely, if I was in the guiding service, I would definitely have a reflector oven.
I actually wrote about it in the Sporting Journal one month.
Yeah,
and got a lot of feedback from people like, Dutch ovens are better. So it was a little bit controversial. Dutch oven, reflector oven, but you know, The reflector oven is really, that's kind of a Maine guide thing, right?
It's compact and it's lightweight and it's a whole lot lighter than a Dutch oven.
I worked at a tripping camp in the summertime. It was on Craig Pond. There was a camp called Flying Moose Lodge.
Yeah, I know that. I've heard of them.
It was a tripping camp. They did the Allagash every year.
Yep.
Great. And they did it in canvas-covered cedar canoes. Mm. They built the canoes there at the camp.
Wow.
But when I worked there, we'd go down to Mount Desert Island, stay at Blackwoods or Seawall, one of those islands, and hike the park. And I'm telling you right now, a reflector oven and a batch of packaged brownies is a babe magnet. We trolled in girls from all over those parks.
Hey, it's hot brownies. How can you beat it, right?
Yeah. So that was pretty good. Yeah. We got another timeout coming, do we, Jim?
We sure do. We could go for it right now if you're all set.
We sure go right ahead.
All right, and here we go. We'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay, we're back again. And everybody got their coffee refreshed and ready to go again. Matt, why don't you give us some highlights of some of your more memorable guiding adventures?
Well, the first time I did a trip for hire, I mean, once I got my guide license, I did a couple free trips just so I could practice up my skills, know what I was doing. But I booked a trip with Guy and Andy, and they had never caught a brook trout, had never fly fished before. And we did the Waterway Headwater Lakes. We put it in at Churchill, went down Indian Stream, and took out there. And so I said, well, I think I'm pretty sure I could put him in the mouth of a brook and cast a fly there and cast a Homburg fly over there and skidded it over the water there. And, I mean, he caught at least 10 trout that evening, Andy did. And that was the highlight of his life up to that point was to catch a brook trout on a fly rod. I mean, these were 10-inch brook trout. But they were nice, fat brook trout. We took some up and fried them up at the campsite for supper that night, and he was pretty thrilled. So it was kind of neat to see that, you know, to be part of that first time.
Certainly.
And we did Chase Rapids. They had a little bit of a hard time in Chase Rapids, but we made it down through there without any big mishaps. So I think they did upset once.
Yeah.
And Chase Rapids was kind of like, I've done that 200 times, and I kind of know where to go. But for the first timer, if you get off course a little bit, then it kind of compounds your decisions. And quite a few of the sports have had a hard time in Chase Rapids, even though you tell them, just go where I go, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things. I equate it to trying to back up your car in the snow, and you try to turn your wheel, and it just turns into a plow and goes somewhere other way than where you want to go. Once you get off course in that whitewater type of thing, it's hard to get back again.
Yeah, it is. And that's what happens. It's like a calm. They glanced a rock. They got where they didn't want to be. And pretty soon they're really where they don't want to be. And next thing you know, it's like if you get on a rock, get out of the canoe and get on the rock or something. But if you start leaning towards the rock, you're going to be over.
No. Especially if you get an aluminum canoe.
Well, not too many of those anymore.
No, but you skin a rock in an aluminum canoe, you're done. You stick right there. But that's why I never had one. I hated them.
Yeah.
My folks had one.
They stuck on rocks for sure.
And they're noisy. So
I had another trip there. It was the COVID year, 2020. That was I retired the next year, so I did a trip in the fall. And it was a guy and his son's best friend, and the water was really low, so we ended up adjusting the trip start time. So we went up to we put it in at Churchill that time and went up to the Jaws, which is the first campsite up on Churchill Lake. And then we set up camp early, and I said, you want me to try to call a moose? And it was like mid-September, late September, and he said, sure. So I let out a few calls, and pretty soon one grunted back. But the two teenage boys were talking, and they wouldn't stop talking, so the moose really didn't come in. But at like 2 o'clock in the morning, I get woken up by this, you know, and the gravel's crunching under their feet, and I'm listening, and I've said, you know, it's mating season. Either he's trying to mate that cow, or they are. And it was like 20 feet from the tent. It was like I'd spent my whole career into the Maine woods, and I never had been that close to moose doing that before, and the father had heard it too, but two teenage boys, it was awesome, went on for 20 minutes, half an hour, never heard a thing. And so next morning, my customer gets up before me, which is something that's not supposed to happen. If you're the guy, you're supposed to get up first, but he got up before me. And next thing I hear this, Matt, Matt, Matt. And then I heard this splashing. And I said, I know what that is. It's a moose out in the water. So I got out of the tent real quick, just in time to see the moose running away. So, but the moose had kind of given a false charge over towards the campsite and then turned around and left. By the time I got out of the tent, all I saw him was running off in the bushes. But that was probably the same moose that was there that night, wondering, you know. Yeah. But that was, we saw quite a few moose on that trip. The next campsite we stayed at was Chisholm Brook, which is down where Chase Rapids goes into Omazaskis Lake, and I called again that night, and two moose answered me. They didn't come in like they did before, but there was definitely two different moose that were interested in my call.
Yeah, well, that must have thrilled those people to death.
It was pretty exciting, even for me to have them come in that night, and it's like, wow, what's going on out there?
Yeah,
and,
I've had not anything like that, but I had that one trip in Sopa Brook. And I had one going into Chimney Pond, just coming just before you get into the campsite. There she was, standing right in the middle of the trail. She looked at us, and we looked at her, and she looked at us, and we looked at her. She finally stepped off the trail, but when we went by her, we weren't more than 6 feet away. And I come to find out later, she's the campsite moose, and she's used to people, so she wasn't... She didn't run off into the woods and everything, but I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so, but it was an interesting experience. Yeah. So,
I actually did guide a couple of moose hunters last. I guided one on my own, and another one I worked for another outfitter last fall. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed moose hunting, and my people came up, and we went. Probably a lot of people know where Coffee Lost Pond is, and I found some good moose sign over there, and I made this really nice birch bark call, a big one. So your really echoes your call quite a bit. So I was down by the pond and I was calling on my call, and that was echoing all over the pond. I says, there's got to be a moose. It's here and that. You can hear that miles away. And so we kept working along. We'd, you know, go a couple hundred yards and call a little bit, go a couple hundred yards, call a little bit. And pretty soon I heard a moose answer us. And it's like, that's a moose, you know, and it's started getting closer and closer, but once that thing started coming, it was like it came in fast.
Oh yeah.
And it was like, oh, it's only like 5 minutes less till legal time is over, and my customer there was wanting to shoot it with a bow, and I'm thinking to myself, that moose is going to come in, he's going to shoot that with a bow, we're going to be looking for that moose
all night long,
half the night, right? And then we got to get it out of here. But he had a firearm with him, a rifle, and I said, I hope he shoots it with the rifle. And anyway, the moose came in. His son, which was 9 years old, was with him. And, I mean, it was grunting. And when we started raking the alder bushes with a scapula, it really came in. And it came about 30 feet away from my sport. And the son stands up and says, I see him, I see him, I see him, just like that. But the moose didn't go anywhere. Stayed right there. But he decided not. It wasn't a huge moose, but it was a nice moose. And he decided not to shoot, which was kind of relieved, because I was thinking, I'm not going to be trailing this thing around in the woods half the night with an arrow stuck in them, because they don't go right down with an arrow, obviously.
No, I when my son had a permit, they had the permit drawing at Bucksport at the high school. Our Rod and Gun Club hosted it. And they called off Sean Mercer of Bucksport. And I said, oh, no. Because I just didn't want to work that hard. I didn't mind going.
Yeah.
But, well, you roll a moose over and the fun's over. And so but anyway, he called one in. He shot, but he was determined he was going to shoot with a bow, too. And I said, Sean, I'll go with you. You shoot it with a rifle. I said, I'm not going with you. You shoot it with a bow.
Yeah.
I said, I'm not, no way. That'd be too far. Rifle, you get a chance of dropping it. With a bow, I don't think there's much chance of dropping it.
I mean, a deer runs with an arrow, so how much a moose is going to go a long way. I actually got drawn in 19. No, I got drawn, no, yeah, two. Anyway, the last time, I got drawn four times over the years, so I've been pretty lucky. But the last time, my son's in the Navy, and I call him up, and I said, Levi, I said, if you want to come up, you could shoot the moose and I'll guide you. And he was thrilled. In fact, he was, and we shot one right up on, it was the second season, so you could hunt on the actual Allagash, and we shot one right up on Churchill Lake, and it dropped, it, he shot it with a 308, and it took two steps and just fell right in the mud.
Yeah,
which wasn't that great. We had, which wasn't real great, but he was, he's young and strong, and he carried all the we did that gutless quartering.
Yeah,
that Fish and Wildlife has on their website, which I thought was awesome, worked beautiful, and we just within 2 hours we had it all skunned, quartered in the canoe, and headed back to Churchill Dam.
Yeah, I know that seemed like, kind of unusual to me. I watched that program about Alaska, Alaska: The Last Frontier, that Kilcher family that homesteads up there and everything. And when they shoot deer or anything, they dress it out right there and pack up. They got muslin bags they carry with them in their backpacks, and they pack it out.
It's, that's the way to get a moose today. 'Cause they're, I mean, 30, 20 years ago, you could ride around and just shoot a moose on, you know, on the woods roads. But today, you gotta go with it, some good sign. You got to do some calling, and they're not as easy to get as they were 20 years ago by any means.
No, well, a lot of the clear cuts are grown up.
Right.
So they're you know, they're deeper into the willy wax than what they have been. We're going to go to give a little shout out to General Appliance.
It is that time. General Appliance. Oh, it's fallen in my lap. Okay. General Appliance has been a sponsor of ours for many, many years. In fact, I think it's from the beginning. And they are incredibly skilled at what they do as far as anybody interested in gas stoves or any gas appliances. And, of course, the compost toilets, which, since I'm given the thing, you should be saying, ride the wave, baby.
Yeah, ride the wave, baby.
But anyways, no, so they do have the compost toilets, which I've never seen one or used one, but everything that I found out about them, they're really handy, especially if you own a camp that's out in the middle of nowheres. You know, they work really well indoors. You don't have to worry about outdoors. So if you're a snowmobiler, a camper with a snowmobile, or even late fall hunting, I mean, you don't have to worry about the weather. Hey, you've got a nice close, and you've got a warm enclosure that you can be in with it. But anyways, yes, if you have any interest in gas appliances, or if you have any gas appliance issues, he would be the man to contact. And I wish that I would have his number right in front of me, but I don't. But Al Alkins is in Brewer, and he's right there on Center Street.
Yep. I learned a valuable lesson from him. I had a problem with my propane. I bought a propane Coleman stove, and I kept running out of gas with those little bottles and stuff. And he said, people make a mistake about, they say, how long will this go? And that's not what it's about. He said, that bottle holds so many BTUs of energy. And you find out how many BTUs it takes to run that stove. It'll put out so many BTUs per hour, and you can figure what you need for gas. And that's the only way to figure it. You figure out the BTUs per hour, your stove or lantern or whatever it uses, and then that way, that's how you calculate how much propane you need.
Yeah. My son bought me a little fitting. You could refill those on like off a 100-pound tank.
Yeah.
Which,
oh, yeah.
So I haven't refilled one yet. I got some empties I got to refill because you always want to have a few extra ones of those.
Well, when we go to Big Eddy now, I take a 25-pound tank and hook it up to my stove. I run my lantern off the bottles, but my Coleman stove, I hook it up to I take the big fella.
Yeah, they have a tree that hooks up to your tank, and then you can put a light at the top, and you also have a side.
Yeah,
really handy.
Yeah. So, Matt, for new people going into guiding, what are some of the common misconceptions or missteps that people make when they first go into the guiding situation?
Well, you know, I didn't do it this way, but you'd be better off, you know, going to work for another guide for a while. And because it's just like everything else, right? People need workers everywhere, including helping with guides. I know what Dave Connolly there for Canoe the Wild, he's a really good guide down east. And does a lot of Allagash trips. I mean, I'm sure if you went to him and said, you know, Dave, I'd like to go guide and learn some things from you, stuff, he'd, he'd, he would he'd hire you, and he might take you on at the beginning just as a helper, and you might work for tips or something like that.
Yeah. But so one of the biggest mistakes you're saying is kind of people just need a guy's license striking right out on their own without
it's a lot of responsibility to take those people out there. You got to buy a lot of stuff. I mean, and like one of the things I first bought was one of those InReaches. It's like a satellite texting device for emergencies. You could have all this gear. I mean, I don't think you could ever stop buying more gear, right? Because you always need you always want to do something different or get into another venue or something, and so you need more stuff.
Yeah,
and so that, there's no end to that either.
Well, gear is kind of like flies.
Yeah,
you know, most flies are tied to catch fishermen, not fish.
Right.
You only need a few simple patterns, and you're good to go.
Yeah, but there's always one you need when you don't.
Yeah,
there's always one you need that you don't have, right?
Yeah, there's nothing more true than that. But
I'd take the, you know, if you want to be a guide, I'd recommend taking one of those, go to one of those guide schools. I know that Carol Ware, he used to write for the Sporting Journal. He runs a really good one, because one of my Rangers that when I was in the Allegash, he took his course, and this is Trevor O'Leary. He's better in the woods than I am. He, you know what I mean? He didn't really need to take the course, but he wanted to make sure he had that map and compass
stuff down.
So he went to Carol's school, and he passed in flying colors. As a matter of fact, when he left the guide board, they told him, you're the type of guy we want to have for main guides. And one of the things that I would recommend, I've seen some of the guys going into the test, you know, when you're a guide, you're representing the state of Maine. I mean, I had a career as a ranger and stuff, and I knew I was always representing the state of Maine. So I always wanted to look sharp, you know, and be clean-cut looking. And I think that's – when you go take that test, you know, don't go in there with your dirty clothes and, you know, untucked stuff. And, you know, so kind of look sharp, because that goes a long way for you getting your license if they think that you're going to be a good representative for the state of Maine.
Yeah. When my friend and I guided together, we had an agreement that when we get meals, when we were on the river, stuff, we were a little bit more relaxed. But when we were in campsite, stuff, we had a green chamois shirt with a guide's patch on.
Yep.
And we both had the green the L.L. Bean chamois shirts, just like the one you got on, only the green one. And that was it. And you know, and we had long pants on. We didn't wear shorts in camp. Yeah. And we always bloused our boots with blousing rubbers.
There we go. You're looking the part.
So we wanted people to feel like we looked like what they would expect us to look like.
Yeah, I got a Johnson wool jacket, the green wool jacket, and I got my main guide patch on that. And in fact, the moose hunters that I guided for Dave Conley last fall, they took a shine to that main guide patch. So they really liked it. They said, because we were talking about trading stuff or whatever. They said, I like that main guide patch. Of course, they didn't get it.
But, no.
But on the Johnson wool jacket, it looks like it's in the right place, right?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why I had a conversation with people at Beans about this. I'm not big on the new fabrics, you know, Gore-Tex and all that kind of stuff. I'm a wool guy. I got a wool shirt on right now. I like wool. But the guy down there at Beans got me one day. I said, you know, I can go out with my wool hunting jacket on in the pouring rain. And I said, I'll get a little damp through it, but I won't soak through and get wet and everything.
Right.
He said, no, but the difference is when I come back with my Gore-Tex jacket, I'm dry and it weighs the same as it did when I left.
True.
He said, that wool jacket, when you come back, it's going to weigh about 15 pounds. So... He got me on that one. I had to give him the.
Actually, when my son came up deer hunting, he lives in Virginia. I was stationed in Virginia in the Navy, and he came up and I told him, you got to have a pair of Johnson wool pants. You got to have a wool this and a wool that. And he says, Dad, he says, I got stuff that's better than wool. He says, it'll keep me warm. So it's just I'm kind of old fashioned, same as you. Well, I like my wool pants. I like my wool jacket.
Well, it's a generational thing. Your son's still in the Navy?
Yes, he is.
Do me a favor. Next time you contact him, tell him that the fellow that you had on the radio show told him to thank him for his service, and we appreciate it.
And he gets. I think he looks at the online version, and they can for free on the Sporting Journal. Yep. And, uh,
but
Yeah, I will.
I made a habit of doing that about 5 or 6 years ago. Anytime I see somebody with a hat on or a uniform, I shake the hand, thank them for the service. My wife and I were in Florida, and there was this big old black gentleman sitting at a Denny's. And I went up because he had a Vietnam veterans on. And I said, I want to thank you for your service because when you deserved it, you didn't get it.
That's very true.
And he broke right down bald right there. It really kind of moved me. I think that's important for people. I've been trying to teach my grandkids to do it, but they're a little shy yet. They don't like to do that. But
yeah, actually, I'm an EMT. I work per diem ENT more in the wintertime. And occasionally we'll go to a call at somebody's house. You know, and usually they're, when we go to a call, it's usually not the best time for them, right?
No.
And I'll see some things on the wall that will say, this guy's a veteran.
Yeah.
Right? And I'll say, and I'll do exactly what you said. You know, I see that you get some pictures up there. Were you in the service or what branch? And I always thank him for his service.
Yeah.
Because it is important to recognize those people. And a lot of guys came back from Vietnam in that era, and they did not get a thank you. They get the opposite.
See, that was my era. I graduated from Maine Maritime Academy in 1968. Mm. And I went to in the Merchant Marine. I didn't go overseas. They had a thing that we got commissioned as in a Navy commission when we graduated because they wanted commissioned officers on all the merchant ships. So if this is interesting how the government works. If the big balloon went up and they nationalized the merchant fleet, I'd have been the captain.
Yeah.
And the captain would have been the navigator. But I'd been the captain. I'd been in charge of the ship. You go figure that one out. I was an engineer. but that was part of our training. So, but I didn't. I went to Vietnam, but it was on a merchant ship, not.
Okay. Yeah, well, his next duty is going to be Washington. Yeah, actually, he's going out on the Nimitz for, I think, 6 months, and he's going to be out of Washington State. And he'll pretty much have his 20 years in after he gets done to that. Yeah. So I'm hopefully going to go to Washington State and shoot something out there.
Yeah.
a black tail or an elk or a mule deer or something.
Now, going back to your guiding thing, have you ever done any guiding bear hunters?
I actually have not guided bear hunters. I've hunted bear. And now I know why people shoot small bears, because when you sit there for 3 or 4 hours and one finally comes and he looks pretty big, so they shoot it. I've hunted, but I have not guided any bear hunters.
Yeah, that is something that I never had real interest in. As a matter of fact, I don't even know if I'd shoot a bear if I saw one in the woods. But I've had bear meat, and it was good.
Yep.
We have at our Rod and Gun Club, we have a game dinner where everybody brings something. We do a potluck, and invariably, if somebody has some bear meat, and they make meatloaf or meatballs or something out of the bear meat, and it's always, you know, it's always good. But I never had that. You know, I was deer hunting with my brother-in-law one time, and we saw some bears get, and he said, "Oh, I want to shoot a bear! I want to shoot a bear!" I said, "Look, you shoot a deer, I'm obliged to help you all out." I said, "I won't drag a bear, damn dance. You're on your own."
Oh, all right. 1 minute.
So give your information again, Matt, about how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, check out my brand new updated website, mainwoodsguide.com, www.mainwoodsguide.com, and let me know what you think about it. There's a little link there. You can make a comment and send it to me, and let me know what you think.
Yeah.
And it's been a pleasure being here with you, Bob.
Well, I've enjoyed it. It's good because it's almost just like sitting on the couch somewhere having a cup of coffee and talking, which is good. You know, the second guy I've had, I had Randy Spencer on one time from Grand Lake Stream. And
the singing guide.
Yeah, the singing guide. And I enjoyed him. That was fun.
I like his columns.
His columns
are always good.
I like his books. Yeah. I really like his books a lot. But that's what you need to do. You need to write a book, man.
I have a hard time coming up with my article each month.
Well, you do like Paul does. You get paid twice. You take those articles, get paid for writing them, and then you put them together in the book, get paid again.
Isn't that what John Ford kind of pretty much did?
Well, I think we need to sign off or else we're running out of time.
Okay.
Okay.
It's been fun.
We'll catch you next week on Maine Outdoors.
Maine Outdoors.